And we welcome you to another edition here on Book Corner. Tony Basilio, proud to be with our special guest and our guest of honor today, Steve Currier. He is the author of The California Golden Seals, A Tale of White Skates, Red Ink, and one of the NHL's most outlandish teams. Steve is the hockey historian, member of the Society for International Hockey Research, lives in warm, sunny, and balmy Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, and is a proud member of the Seals Booster Club, creator and moderator of one of the tribute sites as well, the tribute site called GoldenSealsHockey.com. And Steve, great day to you. Appreciate you taking some time for us. Thanks for being here, my friend.
Oh, no problem. I'm glad to be here.
And I want to give a shout out to one of the great podcasts out there, Good Seats Still Available, with Tim Hanlon. But if you could, I heard you tell an incredible story to him about how you got involved in this whole Golden Seals project. Before we talk about the Golden Seals, who they were, what they were.
Well, the California Golden Seals were one of the first modern-day expansion teams in the National Hockey League. They came in 1967 when the NHL decided to double in size. At the time, there was only six teams, and then they decided to double the number of teams, mainly to avoid competition from the minor league Western Hockey League, which was thinking about it becoming a major league itself. So the Seals were one of the teams that the NHL decided to create in the San Francisco Bay Area, again, hoping to counter the Western Hockey League's plans to become a major league. The NHL was, I think, hoping to avoid a sort of AFL-NFL situation that they had in football by putting teams in Los Angeles and in Oakland and other Western locations like Minnesota, for example. And in doing so, it kind of killed the Western Hockey League plans to become a major league and remained a minor league for the rest of their existence. So that's how the Seals came into the NHL.
And you came to the Seals how? Which is a great story.
I was born in 79, so I was actually born a year after the team folded for good. So I never saw them play. If you've ever looked on YouTube to find clips, there's really not a lot available out there. I have no reason to really feel any sort of attachment to this team whatsoever, but as I was a kid growing up, I would see little reminders here and there. I'd see photos, I would see hockey cards or something like that with the uniform. And one of the first hockey magazines I remember my father bought for me was in 1988 or so, and it was for the 20th anniversary of expansion. And it had a great photo of a player named George Swarbrick, who had the California Seals, as they were known at the time, their road uniforms. And it was a very, very interesting-looking logo, and it was a very cool-looking uniform, that something that didn't exist in the NHL at the time, that whenever I was a kid. And it just kind of planted the seeds, I think, for future research. And as I kind of went along, I would see these little reminders. I would see hockey cards when I go to card shows or something, and I would see in this other sticker book that I had where it talks about a couple of players who were still in the NHL back in the late 80s, and it would say next to their stat line, it would say something like CAL. And it was very odd that this team existed, because there was nothing in the NHL of the 1980s that told you this franchise even played a game. There was absolutely no link to them as far as I knew. And so seeing this little reminder here and there was very interesting. So as I got a little bit older, I was maybe about 11 or maybe about 12 or so, I'd written to the National Hockey League. I asked them kind of naively, I'd said, would you send me some information on not just the California Seals, but every other defunct franchise from the 70s. So the Atlanta Flames and the Kansas City Scouts and the Colorado Rockies and all these other ones. And someone at the NHL office, I still know who it was, but they just photocopied one of the Seals media guides, and they sent that to me. And that was really what got the ball rolling, because I had in front of me, I had all these statistics. I had pretty much the entire franchise history right in front of me. This is long before the internet. This is like in the early 90s, maybe 92 or 93 or so. So there was really nothing out there. And I had in my hands, I had the entire franchise history. So as I started to study this book, I was going over it over and over and over again. I'd bring it to class, and I would, after I'd finished my work, I'd sit there and I'd kind of go through it and look at the stats and see these very interesting and strange names that would come up over and over again. These players like Norm Ferguson and Joey Johnson and Dave Hrecicy and Gary Simmons, these people I had never heard of before, but they just, they kind of grew on me after a while. And I, as I got older, I started making money myself and buying hockey cards and those kinds of things. It just kind of mushroomed from there. And then I just decided, I couldn't even tell you when I started. I decided to put the information together and to start writing little synopses for each season. And it just kind of grew from there until it just became a book.
And that's what's incredible to me is you're an 11-year-old kid and you're sitting there and you have a vision and you're just like, you know, I'm thinking about doing this one day. When you shared that vision with other people, hey, I'm going to write a book, what'd they say to you?
I didn't really talk about it too much, actually. I don't think I ever really expected to publish it, to be quite honest. I think it just, as I got older and I got into my 20s, then I started seeing like, well, okay, this is a project that could actually go somewhere. When I was able to start interviewing players and I was able to find actual newspaper articles online, and now it's so easy to find newspaper articles. You can just sign up to a website, pay, you know, $50-$60 for a 6-month subscription, and you have newspaper articles from, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years and thousands of different newspapers, and you're able to really get the most information possible and answer all of your questions. At the time, I really didn't have any real plan to publish anything. It just wasn't complete enough. There was no way to really, I think, get all the information together until the internet came along, and then that's when it started to become a real, like a concrete project. And then when I started telling people that I was planning on writing this book, they were all very interested. Most people kind of didn't even know the team existed. There's always this period where you have to kind of explain what the team actually is before you go into talking about the content of the book. Still something I get now when people at work, like I teach French to government employees here in Ottawa. Once in a while, get a new student come along and say, hey, I heard you wrote a book, and a lot of them have no idea what this team is all about. So I think that's the reaction that I get the most when they find out that I've written this book is, what is this team? Because there's no real link, or at least not a very obvious link to the SEALs in today's NHL.
You know, it's so funny. I had a similar fascination with the SEALs, though never acted on it. But I was sitting there as a kid. As a collector of hockey cards, you know, I grew up in the Northeast. I was a fan of the Broad Street Bully Flyers back in the 70s. I got to tell you, as somebody that was really into hockey at that point and was really into the NHL, there's something about that Kelly green and gold, those uniforms. And I know the SEALs players, we'll talk about this in a second, but I love that color combination. I thought they were really awesome looking uniforms. In fact, I think hockey has some of the greatest uniforms in all of our North American sport. And I think the SEALs, as loud as they were kind of emblematic of what the 70s were, you know?
In a lot of ways, yeah. Like you were saying, the uniforms were very loud, but that was really the thing that you found everywhere in hockey. It seemed like if it was the World Hockey Association or the NHL, there was all these loud uniforms, but they really stand out more than baseball or basketball. So baseball and basketball, usually the logo is not even on the uniform. It's just a little on the hat, or in basketball, you don't see the logo at all in some cases. And in hockey, I think it just adds a little something. And the colors were always a little bit brighter. The uniform designs were a little wilder. They experimented a lot more. We'll go into the skates that they used to wear, which is another example of how hockey used to really take it to another step when it came to uniforms. I don't think they actually sold any more uniforms than the other sports, but
right.
it definitely made them stand out. And the pictures and the photos that you end up seeing, there's more character, I find, to a lot of these uniforms, and it adds something to the overall history of the sport, I think.
Yeah, and the thing about the SEALs were they were lovable losers, and they were part of, as you talked about earlier, the great expansion, where the NHL essentially went from the original six, they double in size in 67, and they go East Coast, West Coast. That's where the Philly team came in, my Flyers. And then they hit the West Coast because, let's face it, baseball earlier in the decade had hit the West Coast. The AFL was doing some things on the West Coast. But, you know, as I learned in my business, I'm a radio guy. I do a sports radio show in Knoxville. And I call in a lot of small business owners. And one thing that is true of any type of business that you're in when you're trying to attract folks, location, and somewhere along the way, these really wealthy people that got involved on the initial end with the Golden SEALs, they misread that deal because they could have played in San Francisco, and if they would have played in San Francisco, they might still exist. But that Oakland deal was a non-starter, wasn't it? And I'd like you to elaborate on that.
Yeah, so you're totally right when you say that Oakland was a mistake, and it wasn't the city of Oakland itself that was the problem. There's a number of reasons why they put the team in Oakland, but they should have kept them in San Francisco. That's where the team was originally located when they were a minor league franchise in the Western Hockey League. So the San Francisco Seals, they were called at the time, came into existence in 1961. They won the league championship twice in 63 and 64, and they were one of the best attended teams in the league. And one of the reasons why the NHL was thinking that San Francisco would be, or at least the Bay Area would be, a good location for a team is because of the success they had. When the NHL decided to expand, this is in the mid-60s or so, they want to put a team in San Francisco and Los Angeles. They need to have two teams for two reasons. One, couldn't have one team in Los Angeles, for example. They would have no one around them, and it would be very difficult to develop any kind of rivalry, and it just wouldn't be feasible to have them teams jetting around just for one game in Los Angeles, for example. But having two teams on the West Coast made more sense. The other reason they had two teams on the West Coast was because the CBS television contract that the NHL signed stipulated that they needed to have teams in those two locations, in the Bay Area and in Los Angeles. So that's the reason why they had it there. The Seals owners could have kept the team in San Francisco. They were playing out of a rink called the Cal Palace, which I believe is still there, which tells you how old the rink is. And at the time, even back in the 60s, it was seen as being a very old and dingy sort of rink. It had a lot of rodeos and cattle auctions and things like that, so it didn't have a very good reputation. It kind of smelled like cows all the time and had poor sight lines, and it wasn't really designed for pro hockey. So around the same time, the city of Oakland was building this new rink that would seat only about 12,000, but it was a beautiful new rink they were putting in place for the Golden State Warriors, and a good location for a hockey team. The only problem is that a lot of the fans in San Francisco didn't really want to drive to Oakland to watch games. Some were personally insulted that the team was moving across the Bay to another city, and others, from what many players and people who live in the Bay Area have told me, they say that there's a bit of a rivalry between San Francisco and Oakland. If you live in Oakland, you don't go to San Francisco for almost any reason whatsoever, and if you're in San Francisco, you don't go to Oakland. Oakland's very blue-collar. San Francisco is a bit more upper class, I guess you could say, a little pseudo-sophisticated. So fans in each city didn't really want to go to the other city if they didn't have to. And so all of the hockey fans who were in San Francisco weren't going to Oakland, and Oakland didn't really have much of an attachment to the team. So there was it was a really bad decision to put the team in Oakland, even though they had a nice new rink. The players used to love playing there, and when opposition teams would come in, they thought it was great, it was a beautiful rink, but they weren't getting any fans. And that ultimately became the team's biggest downfall, was putting the team in Oakland, not getting enough fan support, and before long, it's just a matter of time before a team's going to fold if they're not getting the fan support.
So from the very beginning, they're kind of doomed, but they don't really help themselves in terms of their front office. Now, they're not very good to start with. They didn't have some of the muscle in the front offices that some of the other folks have. But, man, they sure did have some great stories from the very beginning. I mean, they were almost a comical franchise right from the start, weren't they?
There was a ton of comical stories that the players have told me when I was interviewing them for this book. And one of the most well-known stories that almost everyone has heard is about the Seals' first NHL coach, Bert Olmsted, who was a bit of a tough, gritty player. He was a Hall of Famer with the Montreal Canadiens, won lots of Stanley Cups. And I wrote in the book that he played with guys like Jean Beliveau and Bernie Geoffrion and Maurice Richard. And those guys got into the Hall of Fame on skill and skating ability and this overall hockey ability. Bert Olmsted got into the Hall of Fame on grit and determination, because he was a hard worker and he was a good hockey player. He went to the corners, and he was someone who would probably skate over his own mother to win a Stanley Cup, like that kind of player, the kind of guy you want on your team. But he wasn't really meant to be an NHL coach, and certainly not on an expansion team. The players the Seals drafted, they drafted some very good players. Some guys who'd won Stanley Cups in Toronto and Montreal, but this was not Jean Beliveau and Rocket Richard. There's no way these guys were going to score 50 goals in a season, and I think that frustrated Olmsted. The fact that these guys seemed that they weren't interested in getting a second chance to play first-line minutes in the NHL. The players were trying their hardest, but they just couldn't produce the way he was expecting them to. So on Thanksgiving Day, this would have been the American Thanksgiving, when they had a practice on Thanksgiving, and after practice, he locked the players in the dressing room. He went home to enjoy Thanksgiving dinner, and the players were left there to their own devices until it was too late, and then he opened the door and let them out afterwards. So this is one story, one of the reasons why the players didn't get along with Olmstead very well. He was frustrated with them. They were frustrated with him. It just got worse and worse as the season went on until he finally decided to resign with about 20 games left in the season. And then he never coached again in the NHL after that.
You don't say. I mean, a guy that would lock you in, you're accidentally, no less, but still, as comical as it wants to be, just part of the great read. And let me say a word about this book as we visit with Steve Currier, The California Golden Seals, Tales of Whitegate's Red Ink and one of the NHL's most outlandish teams in a time where in the late 60s, early 70s, professional sports in this country were pretty outlandish. You had the ABA and the NBA battling. In a short while, you'd have the WHA and the NHL battling. And many of these leagues would leave behind some great stories, some great tales. I think about Terry Pluto's book, Loose Balls, about the ABA. Some of the things written about the WHA. But before you came along, the Golden Seals has pretty much been a story that's gone untold. Does that kind of surprise you? In as much as there, I know the reaction to your book's been very strong.
Is it surprising in a way? I think maybe one of the reasons why it took so long for something to come out was like a little bit like the ABA as well. I don't think there was really a lot of books about the ABA that were written in the 80s and the early 90s, I don't think either. Not to mention a lot of other forgotten teams. Maybe because the internet wasn't around yet and information was still kind of hard to come across. I think that's one of the reasons why there was nothing really written about the Seals. There's little chapters here and there in other hockey books, but these were hockey books that were written at the time, and they were getting the same kind of coverage that the other teams were getting. But after, once they folded, there wasn't really a lot out there. And there is one other book on the Seals, which I'd recommend for anyone who does enjoy reading about the Seals. It's called Shorthanded by Brad Kurtzberg. It details a lot of the Seals' ups and downs and different stories the players have told over the years. I think those are the only two books about the Seals. There's not really much else. And the same goes with teams like the Atlanta Flames or the Colorado Rockies. I don't think there is anything about them that's out there. And if there is, I would love to hear about it. But there's not a lot of on these old franchises. It's very rare you see something. You talk about Loose Balls, about the ABA, and there's Tim Hanlon has interviewed a couple of people who have written books about the Indiana Pacers. But there's really not a lot about these old teams. But more and more, we're starting to see that come out. Great, because these are all these great untold stories.
Yep.
As much as I love, I'm a Montreal Canadiens fan, but I've read so many books about the Canadiens, not to mention the Boston Bruins, the Philadelphia Flyers. There's not really much more that I can read about and learn about. And these older teams, these defunct leagues and so forth, are great because there's so many unearthed, unknown stories, and it's really worth reading about them.
And I love stories. And stories, oral history stuff, and that's what your book reads like. It's absolutely huge. I know you poured yourself into it. 464 pages in all. It is a really, really fun read, and I just found myself not able to put this book down at times. In fact, I lost sleep because of you. Actually, it wasn't because of you. It's because I'm a weirdo. But that said, you kept me up many a night reading the California Golden Seals, and I always saw hockey back then as so much more big time than it truly was. You know, you went into the arena. It was bright. It was flashy, and it seemed big time. Looking back on it, though, there were some franchises that were being held together by duct tape and baling wire. You mentioned the Colorado Rockies before. They were one of them. The Seals were certainly one of them. And one thing I learned from your book is the Montreal Canadiens, they didn't just overtake my Flyers accidentally there in the mid-70s and become a dynasty till the Islanders came along, and then they handed it off to the Edmonton Oilers. That was pure front office genius. And there's one of the all-time greats in Guy Lafleur, who, if the Seals had a decent organization, would have played there. I want you to share the story of how not only did they manipulate the Seals to get that pick, but then they manipulated the season itself, which is an all-time great sports story, as we visit with Steve Currier. Take it.
Yeah, that's one of the most famous stories involving the Seals, because Guy Lafleur ended up in the Hall of Fame. He won 5 Stanley Cups, a scoring champion, and as most people know, the Seals very easily could have had him had they played their cards right. What has to be said is that in the late 60s and early 70s, the NHL entry draft didn't really have the same impact that it does today. It wasn't a be-all and end-all. Teams used to trade away their draft picks much more easily back then than they do now. Now, if you're going to trade your first round pick, especially if you're already a weak team, you're probably going to hang on to that until draft day. Unless an absolutely phenomenal offer comes along, you're not getting rid of that pick. The Seals, in their case, were like many of the other teams, the expansion teams especially, they trade these draft picks away because teams like the Montreal Canadiens or the Boston Bruins would say, hey, I've got this great player. He's playing on our third line, but he used to be a consistent 20-goal scorer. We'll trade you this guy for your first-round pick, and, you know, it's going to be great. And these expansion teams would take on these players, and these players were often on the tail end of their careers. They maybe have a year or two left in them, but then teams like the Canadiens or the Bruins would have these high draft picks, and they would get these phenomenal players like Guy Lafleur or, you know, Larry Robinson or one of these kind of guys. And this went on for several years. It wasn't really until the 70s came along when these teams started realizing that this is a bad move to get rid of these picks. So the Seals in the 1969-70 season were kind of puttering along. They made the playoffs, but they just by the skin of their teeth. And you could see that this was a team that was kind of falling apart. They'd had a good year the year before, but they were getting older, they weren't as productive, and you could see the writing on the wall. This was probably not going to end well. And sure enough, the year later, in 1970-71, they started off pretty well, but then by about Christmas, they started getting on these long losing streaks, and they were done. So Sam Pollock could see, he was the general manager of the Montreal Canadiens, and he could see that the Seals was a good chance they were going to be finishing last. And you could see the year before, there was a good chance that even if they didn't finish last, they were probably going to finish pretty low in the standings. So the year before, he traded his first-round pick to the Seals for their first-round pick, which seemed like a very innocent deal, one first-round pick for another, but Sam Pollock knew his Canadiens were going to finish near the top of the standings, and the Seals were probably going to finish much lower. There wasn't a lot to lose in making that switch. They're probably going to get a better draft pick out of it. No guarantee they're going to get the first overall pick, but they're going to get a better draft pick. Well, as the 70-71 season goes along, and the Seals are sinking lower and lower into the standings, it looks like there's a good chance they're going to finish last overall. And Pollock knew that Lafleur was the consensus number one pick in the draft that year. So in order to help the Seals finish last, he traded Ralph Backstrom, who was a pretty good player, but maybe on the downside of his career, he traded him to Los Angeles for a couple of minor leaguers. And L.A. all of a sudden started to get better, and they moved ahead of the Seals in the standings. And the Seals ended up finishing dead last in not only in their division, but overall in the league. So it was because of this trade that Pollock made and others that he made with Los Angeles, it helped the Seals finish last. And at the time, if you finished last in the standings, you got the first overall pick. So when the Seals finished last, that pick was transferred over to Montreal, and they were able to pick up Guy Lafleur.
Gangsta is what that is. Not only do you manipulate one franchise to give you a pick when you're pretty good and they're awful, that's already a fleecing of a team. Then you turn around and you look at the league and you go, no, wait a second. I want this guy. So how about if I send them a little juice? The Kings don't really know what we're doing here. Because the Kings would almost have to go, these days there's no way. These days tanking is in vogue when it comes to getting a number one pick. Think about that for a second. Back then, they're so unwise as to what's this guy is just basically moving people around. And in the early days of hockey, and I know this was still going on in the early 70s. I think they stopped it in the mid-70s, if I'm not mistaken. But they already had this protection of a couple French-Canadian guys or guys in Quebec. That was the rule back then, right?
Yeah, and this is, coincidentally enough, it was right before Guy Lafleur was about to become available that they changed this rule. I believe the year before, the Canadiens got Mark Tardif and Réjean Houle, I believe. The year after, they decided to stop this practice because I think at this point they figure the Canadiens are strong enough. They don't need this extra advantage. They were already perennial Stanley Cup contenders, that they didn't need this extra boost. So they ended up changing this rule, but it didn't affect the Canadiens at all. They just continue to make these trades with other teams. And if you look at the list of players drafted in the amateur draft, as it was called at the time, from like 1971 to about 1974, you'll see that Montreal always finished at the top of the standings. But they always had one of the highest draft picks, maybe not the first overall, but they'd have like the third or the fourth draft pick, and they'd have a lot of first-round draft picks. Because these other teams were just constantly trading their draft picks away to Montreal, and Montreal would pick up these guys. They'd get Bob Gainey, they would get Larry Robinson, they would get Bunny LaRocque, and all these other useful players, not necessarily star players, but these useful players that were just stacking the team. And these guys were with the Canadiens throughout those Stanley Cup, that Stanley Cup dynasty.
Yeah.
Most of those guys were all drafted in the first or second rounds, and a lot of those picks were not Montreal's own picks. They were from other teams. So they were able to take risks and draft like a Bob Gainey in the first round, even though he was no superstar in junior hockey, but they had so many first-round picks, they could just take a flyer on these guys. If they panned out, great, and if they didn't, it didn't hurt them at all. Sam Pollock in particular was a genius for what he did to keep his team winning consistently like that. That shouldn't even be possible in any kind of pro sport, but he managed to keep them contenders every year that he was there.
The passion of Steve Currier is greatly appreciated. He's a hockey historian. He's a member of the Society for International Hockey Research. He joins us from Ottawa, Ontario, where he's a proud member of the Seals Booster Club. He's also the creator and moderator of a tribute site called GoldenSealsHockey.com. And I would encourage you to go ahead and check that site out and look at some of the colorful pictures and the characters and some of the stuff there and the stories. But it's all here in the California Golden Seals, a tale of white skates, red ink, and one of the NHL's most outlandish teams. This is available from University of Nebraska Press. This is a really great read. It is a lot of fun. And let's get to Charlie Finley, because when we talk about great reads and fun, and there's been things written about Charlie Finley in the past, but the biography stuff I've read of him, not much is mentioned about his time as the Golden Seals owner. I don't want to say people have tried to suppress that, but it's almost as if that's just not seen as an important part of the narrative, when the truth is it's a really important part of the narrative, because this guy was Looney Tunes.
I think one of the reasons why Finley, they don't talk about his time with the Seals very much, is that I don't think he really cared much about the team. As most people who were involved with the Seals would tell you, they sometimes would say, yeah, I was there for 2 or 3 years and I met him twice. Nowadays, most professional athletes will have met their owner a couple of times, a year at least. But Finley wasn't someone who spent a lot of time with the Seals. He was more involved with his Oakland A's. There he was a really awful micromanager. He'd be involved in scouting. He'd be involved in player trades and all sorts of decisions on field and off the field. With the Seals, he was kind of hands-off. And you definitely see that in the interviews I did with the players. In many cases, they're upset that he didn't take more of a hands-on approach to the team. It's one of the reasons why they didn't do very well. When he did get involved with the team, it usually was a disaster. The first thing that he did when he bought the team, they were then known as the Oakland Seals. And when he bought the team in 1970, the first thing he announces at his first press conference, and you can see this in a recent documentary on the Seals by Mark Gretschmiel called The California Seals Story. In this first press conference that Finley gives, you can see him say, "I know nothing about hockey." And the camera pans to Bill Torrey, who is the executive vice president of the team at the time, and Torrey just looks absolutely exasperated hearing his owner saying this, that he knows nothing about hockey. And it showed, because Finley made all sorts of strange decisions. He, for one thing, called the team the California Golden Seals. He changed the uniform colors from a very dark forest green, blue, and white, turned the uniforms into, as you were saying before, bright yellow, Kelly green, and white, just like his Oakland A's. He put this team in green and gold skates, which was unusual at the time, but other teams actually decided to do that. They adopted the color skate. Pittsburgh, and I believe Toronto also did that for a little bit. St. Louis might have as well. The following season, he decides to take it up a notch, and he decides to give his team white skates, which is what if you ask anyone about the Seals, what do you know about the team, they'll say they wore white skates. And they absolutely did. The first season, you can see in pictures, the skates were bright, bright white. I interviewed one of the stick boys who was with the Seals for a few years, and he said that they used to paint the skates with latex house paint after almost every game, because Finley insisted that those skates be white, white, white every game. He thought they looked phenomenal. As you know, white skate during a hockey game is going to, the pucks are going to hit it, it's going to get stick marks, they're going to get scuffed, there's going to be little black marks everywhere, so you have to paint those constantly. And the players would say, I thought it was a bit of a joke, but I think they were actually serious when they said that those skates would get heavier and heavier as the season went on, because he kept slapping paint on every game, every 2 games. It might be a coincidence, but the season they brought in the white skates, they were actually playing pretty well. But after about a month of wearing the white skates, they start to lose an awful lot of games, and they went into a massive slump towards the end. So is it because the skates were getting heavy and they were literally losing a step on the other teams? Mm-hmm. It's possible, but the players definitely told me that they said that the skates were getting heavier and heavier as the season went on.
So great.
The team never did very well with those white skates. Once they got rid of them, they started playing a little bit better. So did the white skates have a detrimental effect on the players? It probably bruised their ego a little bit because they'd be yelled at, and fans would yell at them and say they look like figure skaters. If you looked at them on TV, it looked like they were skating on stumps because the ice was white and the skates were white. So it was just a terrible decision by Finley to do that. But he thought it was great. He thought it was good for publicity. He thought it would get the team attention. And it did, and it still does today, but it definitely didn't help the team win or get any more fans.
I love the concept of you keep spackling paint, and not just any kind of paint, but a thick home kind of paint that you would use, and just keep spackling paint on there, keep spackling paint. Sooner or later, what weighed this now weighs a little more and a little more, and I can see that. I mean, I think anybody could see that. Let me ask you, when, through your research or anything, did any of those former players, anybody, keep any of those skates? Are any of those skates still around?
Morris Mott, who I talked to, he might have two pairs of those skates, actually. I think he donated one to the Hockey Hall of Fame, so you can definitely find a pair there. I believe he kept another one as well, but I might be thinking of Marshall Johnson. I think he kept the white skates as well. But I think a lot of the players kept them. Not necessarily the full white skates. Some are more of a white and green combination skate that came in, I think, the year later. But, yeah, a lot of players kept those skates, and they kept a lot of the other things that Finley gave the team. Finley gave the players these green blazers that he had them wear on the road when they went to visit other teams. So if you saw the SEALs at the airport when they just got off the plane, you'd see these 20-odd players wearing these garish green jackets like you went at the Masters, walking through the airport all together. They would all carry these disgusting-looking bright green and gold suitcases with them, so they all matched wherever they went on the road. And a lot of the players that have hung on to all those souvenirs, I guess you could say. Finley was a very odd sort of owner in the sense that he didn't like to give money away to his players. He was very stingy. He didn't like to give raises, and if he did, it was usually the smallest possible raise. But he loved to spread the wealth when it came to his players' comfort. He wanted them to eat in nice restaurants. He often paid for steak dinners if they played a good game. He'd give shutouts for bonuses, $300 bonuses for shutouts and hat tricks. He'd give his players matching luggage and suits, and he'd go out and buy them suits. They won against teams like Montreal or Boston. So he was very generous in that sense, and the players appreciated that. But what they really wanted was to be paid like other players around the league. And this goes for the Oakland A's or the California SEALs. They just weren't paid very well. And so whenever they got the opportunity in hockey, when the World Hockey Association came in and was offering anyone who could wear a jock strap, they were offering anyone double and sometimes triple their salaries, all the SEALs players took off because Finley was never going to give them more than a few $100 or $1,000 raise from 1 year to the next. So they all took off. And the Oakland A's did the exact same thing whenever free agency was introduced in baseball. Everyone took off. Catfish Hunter and Vida Blue and Reggie Jackson and all those other guys, they all took off because Finley was a tightwad. Even though at times he could be very generous, but he was very difficult to work for. He was also very, very stingy when it came to salaries.
He didn't know a thing about hockey, but he sure did leave a mark. And that's kind of the fun of what you talk about here in this book, because I get the sense from the guys you interviewed that though it was kind of a failure and though they weren't very good, there are a lot of people that have terrific memories of this really colorful franchise that was just there like a supernova, there and gone.
Yeah, the players, you have to remember that playing in the Bay Area was a nice experience. It was a wonderful place to play hockey. They loved living in the Bay Area. It was very comfortable. It was warm year-round. They could go to practice and then go to the beach afterwards. They loved living in the Bay Area. They could walk around and they wouldn't get a lot of attention, so they were almost anonymous. There wasn't a lot of pressure on them. It was a fun experience for them. And sometimes I think these shared experiences of, you know, wearing the white skates and the constant losing, it bonded a lot of these guys together. Some of them still communicate with each other. They still hang out once in a while. In October, there was an event in Toronto that I attended, the SEALs' 50th anniversary, and there was Joey Johnson, Reggie Leach, Wayne King, and Marv Edwards were all there, and these were all guys that played together. They had these shared experiences, and they have very warm memories of playing in Oakland. They look back on it now, and they laugh about it, but it wasn't necessarily funny at the time, but they look back now and they say, you know, this was a fun experience. It wasn't a great team, but it was still the NHL, and that was what they'd always wanted as kids, to play professional hockey, and they accomplished it. It was just a very weird place to be doing it, but they seemed to enjoy what they did, and the memories they have, they're certainly more than happy to share them.
Is there still a significant number of people there that relate to and maybe even dream about a day if the Golden Seals could have made it and they could have kept their franchise instead of what they have over in San Jose right now in the Bay Area? Are those folks still out there, and have they shown themselves to you as this book is dropped and then your website?
There's a few cases of people I interviewed that believe that the team could have been successful had they gone differently in certain ways. Like, go back to when they moved the team to Oakland originally, that was a big problem. The World Hockey Association was number two. If the Seals hadn't lost the nucleus of their team there, there's a good chance they probably would have survived. The franchise ended up losing a lot of games after the World Hockey Association came in. If they'd been able to draw more fans, they probably would have had a reason to build a new rink in San Francisco, which was the original plan. Talk to Gary Simmons, the goaltender, and he emphatically stated that if they built that rink in San Francisco, the Seals would still be in San Francisco today, and they'd be prospering like crazy. And you look at the San Jose Sharks, they didn't start off any better than the Seals. They were awful their first few years, but the fan support was there. But that's San Jose, and San Francisco being, I believe, I'm not really familiar with the geography of the Bay Area, but I'm pretty sure it's very close to San Jose. It's on the same side. You look at the fan support in San Jose, it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
There's definitely fans that believe that a team could have survived there all those years, but they always say that if it hadn't been for those couple mistakes, putting the team in Oakland, WHA coming in and taking half the team away, those were the two final nails in the coffin, I would say. Maybe the last nail in the coffin, I guess, was when they actually tried to get a new rink in San Francisco. Everything was approved with then-mayor of San Francisco, Joe Alioto, and then timing, you know, is everything. He ended up losing the election to George Moscone in 75 or 76, and then the Moscone administration, they decided to look into the arena plans again, and they decided to not go through with building the rink. So, you know, it's, there's a lot of little things that had they just done them differently, had timing been differently, been different, that they could have definitely survived in the Bay Area. And there's a couple of fans I interviewed and players that agreed that, yeah, the team definitely had the potential to stay there. They had the fan support. They just needed a team that was going to win some games. If they had a winner, they could have survived.
Yeah, they drew a decent. They didn't drew great numbers, but they, for as horrible as they were, I mean, that they were getting anybody to go to their games is miraculous. And then that franchise ends up moving to Cleveland, where you talk about atrocious, in an atrocious sports city with great sports fans, by the way, that those hardscrabble Cleveland folks, as we record today, and what they're being put through on the football field by the Haslam family. I mean, this would have been a perfect franchise for the Haslams to own, because the Barons, you talk about an absolute joke. But back to the Seals for a second. With your book, one thing I want to do is I want to go purchase some Seals apparel. Can I do that? Is there any Seals apparel out there?
Yeah, you can. There's quite a bit. You go on eBay, you can find it quite easily. I've seen lots of hats and toques, and jerseys are easy to find now, too. There's a lot of imitations out there on eBay, I've noticed, so you have to really be careful on those. The NHL, I believe, has like a series of classic jerseys that is out. It's usually not easy to find in stores. I certainly can't find any here. And this is hockey country, so it tells you how hard it is to find. But if you go on eBay or maybe even on Amazon, maybe I'll find some jerseys and some hats and some toques. Seals logo is still out there. I'm not really sure who owns it. It's probably the NHL, but there definitely is a lot of merchandise that's out there, like new merchandise and replicas and things like that. Even some of these newer sets of hockey cards in the game or something like that, that feature some Seals players as well. It's definitely out there, but you have to look for it. They usually don't put it out on display in stores. It's more something you have to look online to find, but it's definitely out there.
It's fun stuff, and I'd imagine this was a lot of fun for you. And something that kind of came to you as an 11-year-old kid is you received something in the mail, and like you, I used to send away to leagues and teams back then, and it's funny. You think about the actions of one person, and perhaps that person's still with us that sent you that out of the league office, or maybe they're not. But they had a tremendous impact in your life. Look at some of the things that you've followed along the way. You've written a book here, and it's amazing by that action of that person just taking the time to photocopy an entire, as you say, media guide about the Golden Seals back then, just taking the time to do that for a little kid. I mean, that's pretty awesome if you stop and think about it, man.
Well, the NHL has always been good for that, and the teams as well. Like, I wrote to a lot of other teams as well at the time. I think it started as like a school project. They asked us to just like practice writing letters and stuff like that, and I think I wrote to one team, probably Montreal, and I got something back, and I just started to write for other teams, and then I decided to write to the league itself, and yeah, it's probably the best piece of mail I've ever gotten. Still own that photocopy media guide now upstairs in my files with all my other hockey stuff, and it's great to go over and to go through it sometimes to see what I remember seeing for the first time. It brings back a lot of memories. Then again, I also think maybe someone at the league office was trying to get rid of me and just send me something to shut me up, and they just thought that would be the best thing to send. But I always thought that if they could have sent me any kind of media guide, like they could have sent me something from the Atlanta Flames, I would have been just as happy if they had, because yeah. I was just as interested in them as I was in the Seals. And but if I'd gotten a media guide from another team, it might have led me in a completely different direction, and who knows? It's like the Seals just kind of put into my lap, really. It was just funny that it happened that way, I think.
Those old hockey players are such great athletes to deal with. Current hockey players, having done what I've done, I've had a chance to talk to and be around tons of athletes, retired, active, what have you. Hockey players are just down-to-earth people, man, and they just always have been. And I can imagine that was a lot of fun for you, getting a chance to interface with a lot of those guys. And I'm sure it's been probably a great thing for those guys as well, all these years later, to have somebody seek them out and want to talk to them. Did you get that vibe from a lot of the guys you talked to?
Oh, absolutely. I didn't have one bad experience with anyone I talked to. And this is players, front office people, media members. I didn't have one bad experience with any one of the people that I talked to. Every one of them was incredibly receptive and interested in talking to me about their experiences. I had the privilege of meeting Reggie Leach and Joey Johnson and Wayne King and Marv Edwards at the Seals' 50th anniversary celebration back in October, and they were just the nicest guys. I mean, I'd never met any hockey players in person where I got to actually talk to them, and Reggie Leach in particular, he bought two copies of my book for both of his kids, which was very nice of him, and I gave him a third copy for himself. And as we were talking, he mentioned something about the Seals' ring that he had. He had his Flyer Stanley Cup ring on him. I said, like, I could see whenever you're talking, I could see that ring from a distance. I was like, I was wondering if that was the Stanley Cup ring, and he showed it to me, and he mentioned he had one with the Seals. And I said, oh, yeah, I have a picture of that in my book. Someone had, one of the Seals fans I connected with, he sent me a picture of this ring, and I showed him the picture. He's like, yeah, that's the one I have. It's I think my daughter found it last year or something, and it's this beautiful, it's not a championship ring, obviously, but these rings that Charlie Finley had made for the players. And Reggie said, yeah, I have one of these at home, this Seals ring. Yeah, it was fun to connect with him like that and to hear him talk about something that I'm surprised he remembered getting this ring, that this is a guy who's won Stanley Cups, and he still has that piece of memorabilia, which is one of the rarest pieces of Seals memorabilia. There's only a few of the players that have those now, so it was very interesting to talk about that. And the other players as well, Marv Edwards was a very wonderful speaker. He told stories about how he was on the road for so many years, and him and his wife had moved, I think, 28 times during their careers, and how supportive she was. And he went up to the podium and he spoke directly to her. It was very, very touching. They're very, very nice guys, and everyone I talked to over the phone, they were very, very receptive. Many of the players, after I sent them copies of the book, and they wrote back and they said, no, great job. We're glad you got the story straight. Some sent me autographed photos. Wow. Thank you. And it was really a really nice experience to meet with these guys, to even just to speak with them over the phone and to hear their stories. And I've kept all the interviews that I've done. I digitized all the files. I have every one of them. I'll always be able to go back and listen to them. And if I ever want to pick up more of the stories I wasn't able to put in the book, there might be some information that I could share one of these days as well.
It's been a real pleasure spending a few with you. If I photocopy you a Atlanta Flames media guide from, say, 74, 75, and send that to you and photocopy it, any chance you could do one of these on the Flames? Because I'm telling you, that would be a really interesting book when you think about the South and the 70s, where they were, playing in the old Omni, right up to the Jim Craig days. I mean, as you said earlier, Not putting any pressure on you, Steve, but as you said earlier, there's so many great untold stories out there, especially about a lot of these franchises that are just been cast off to the side and thrown away. Now we see this vibrant hockey world, this vibrant professional sports world. Man, there were a lot of bumps in the road along the way, and the Seals were one, but I kind of want you to do this for the Atlanta Flames. What do you think?
It would be something that I would definitely be interested in doing, but unfortunately right now my next project is actually going to be involving the Kansas City Scouts.
Yes!
That's what I'm yes. kind of diving into that right now. The Scouts 2 years in the NHL, and also the Washington Capitals' first 2 years in the NHL as well. You probably remember that was probably the worst expansion in league history. I think I have this morbid fascination with failure, something that these teams that had the hardest time to have the most interesting and unknown and untold stories. That's my current project I'm working on right now, is researching the Scouts and the Capitals' first 2 years. But I've always had on my radar the Colorado Rockies and the Atlanta Flames as kind of the last of those defunct franchises from the 70s in the NHL anyway. I would love to jump into that one of these days, cover all of those teams and give them the proper treatment.
One observation for you when you do your thing about the Caps, you can attribute this to me if you want, but if you go back and look at a lot of the Topps cards back then, I don't know what the deal was, if their photog worked or lived in the Washington area, but so many of the pictures are shot against the Capitals. Go back and look at it. I don't know what the deal was, but maybe you want to capture somebody when they're in a position of power, and playing against one of those franchises was a pure position of power, but that is going to be a lot of fun. I bet that Rockies book and the Capitals, I bet that's going to be a lot of fun. One thing I like to do here is allow my authors to have a final word. And Steve Currier, you, the author of California Golden Seals, go ahead, my friend. I'm going to turn the floor over to you, and thanks for your time.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show. It's been great. It's always great reminiscing about, you know, the process I went through to write the book, and also just to talk about different memories that you have and that memories I have about writing the book and stories I heard about the Seals. It's a great ride to do this. It took a long time to get it exactly the way I wanted it, but I'm glad that so far the reception's been really good and feedback's been great. I was very happy that just the players enjoyed it. That was really the thing I was worried about the most, is that I wasn't going to get something straight, and just glad the players appreciated it. They thought the stories were told honestly, they were told truthfully, and they were entertained, that it brought back a lot of fond memories for them.
And their families will always have it as a keepsake, and I can just imagine how much that means to so many people. Steve Currier, continued success to you, and I want to echo what those players said. I think you hit this thing right on the head, nailed it out of the park. Again, Steve Currier, author of The California Golden Seals, A Tale of White Skates, Red Ink, and one of the NHL's most outlandish teams. Thank you, my friend, for joining.
Well, thank you.
I do want to say that Book Corner and what we do here is a service of TonyBasilio.com and the Tony Basilio Radio Show. It is made possible by our T-Club members. If you listen to today's interview and some of our previous Book Corner interviews and find those to be of value, value us and consider leaving, if you will, a small tip. Anything you could do would be greatly appreciated. Help us with operational cost. Whatever. Nobody's getting rich doing this, but my aim is to keep commercials out of this and to keep this endeavor commercial free. So anything you could do would be greatly appreciated. Again, you can find information for that at Tony Basilio. That's B as in boy, A-S-I-L-I-O, TonyBasilio.com. Once again, I want to thank Steve Currier for joining. The California Golden Seals, A Tale of Skates, White Skates, Red Ink, and one of the NHL's most outlandish teams. Time well spent. Time among friends. That was good stuff. University of Nebraska is your publisher, University of Nebraska Press. And this concludes another edition here of Book Corner.